Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mona and Rebecca. I've been hearing a lot lately about an increase of issuances of these notices of intent to terminate regional centers coming from USCIS. Is that true?
Indeed, Mark. As of February 10th of this year, 2020, there are 783 approved regional centers, which compared to September 16th, just a few months back of 2019, there were 822 EB5 regional centers.
Yes. So we have seen that surge in the denials of regional centers since 2008. We've done our own, account of how many terminations there has been. We've seen around 402 regional centers that have received terminations from USCIS, and we continue to count. Just alone in 2020, as this year has been, 2 months, 3 months, we've seen 8 terminations already.
It's really following a relatively quiet 2019. I would call them the regional center compliance team, or the regional center compliance police, rather. They've been aggressive. They've been super aggressive, and they have been many NOITs, which is a notice of intention to terminate, issued. But I have to say that I do welcome this action. I'll tell you why. There has been such a propagation of regional centers that it's really became a cottage industry at one point. Back in 2015-16, people were putting up regional centers or advising groups to be regional centers when they were clearly not qualified.
Yeah, exactly, Mona. When you refer to not qualified, we can say, and what we have seen, unfortunately, are developers who are very eager to take investors' money, but not so quick to carry out the necessary compliance and oversight for owning a regional center. For instance, recently what we saw filing for the I-924A compliance,
which we do every year towards the end of
exactly. So, we start in September because the fiscal year ends at September 30th and it's due on December 29th of each year. We're starting to notice a lack of response from a lot of our regional center operatives. A lot of them are not responding, or they're coming back and saying, don't worry, we can handle it on our own. And we haven't seen really good results.
Right. We've heard Christina bang her head against the wall several times. I know that much. No, we're laughing, Mark, but it's very serious.
Yes.
Because it's this lack of oversight, this lack of ability to carry out necessary compliance and oversight is really leading USCIS to send out these notices, which I do hasten to say is a good thing. But just before we get into that, Rebecca, let's talk a little about trends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what we have seen in the past is, we started out with 2008, we hardly saw any regional centers. And then all of a sudden, we saw a huge surge.
The cottage industry, as I mentioned.
Exactly, with an all-time high in 2018, with a 2,490% growth in 10 years.
Yeah, so if you want to put that in figures, it's 750. 750, can you imagine it? New uh-huh. regional centers approved in that 5-year period. And I will blame USCIS here because they were just approving them. They were just 1, 2, 3 approving stuff without really looking into what they should be looking into, the ability to do oversight, the need, the market itself. It was at one point crazy.
Exactly. So the all-time high that we've seen is 822 approved regional centers serving 49 states, plus the District of Columbia and 4 U.S. territories, with particularly the highest numbers coming out of California, of course, New York, of course, being there as number 2. But we've also seen the largest denials within those states as well.
Right. Well, New Jersey had 87, and Florida 75, Pennsylvania 70, Texas 73, Washington 62, Connecticut 59, Which were the two states which didn't have a regional center, Rebecca?
Without no regional centers were Delaware, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. So wow. Very small states.
I would have thought Delaware would have had one at least.
Yeah, but I think it's because a lot of the, what happens is in Delaware, a lot of the economic growth is probably in the north, where they've probably attached on to Pennsylvania counties.
Okay, what are the statistics, Rebecca, for the approvals versus terminations?
Yeah, so we discussed all these approvals happening, and then, of course, terminations came in. So between January and September 2019, USCIS terminated 75 EB-5 regional centers while only approving 6.
Good. Finally. Finally.
So that was the larger deficit on the net regional center growth in the history of EB-5. In addition, a total of 130 EB-5 regional centers were terminated as well in 2018, which is a record high. So we've seen a lot of terminations within 2017 through 2019, and I think that number is going to continue to grow.
Rebecca, let me ask you, how does USCIS go about terminating a regional center?
So what USCIS does is they first will send you a notice of intention to terminate, which is the NOIT, in which you have 30 days to respond. And so then, Mona, when they send this notice of intention to deny, what are some of the issues that we're seeing within these notices?
Well, as we have seen, the RC compliance team's out in full force. I would say that going back to 2008 until maybe 2017-ish, what USCIS actually looked for were illegal acts, any regional centers which were involved with fraud or any kind of misrepresentation and complaints, usually SEC complaints. So that's where we saw the initial terminations. However, since 2017 onwards, we've started seeing a different trend. And I would say even not 2017, perhaps 2018 onwards, that according to USCIS's website, and they've had this there for some time, USCIS may terminate a regional center's participation in the program based on activities which don't include, which have not shown enough capital investment or job creation, and a lack of or approved pending 526 or 829 petitions.
Yeah, so what we want to stress is that the I-924A is very, very important for regional center operatives to file.
I hear Mark's voice telling us, what is an I-924A?
You know me so well.
Yeah, we know. We can't keep saying these words. So what is an I-924A, Rebecca?
So as we discussed before, the fiscal year starts from October 1st through September 30th. And so each year, USCIS designated regional centers are required to report their activity by submitting the supplement to Form I-924, which is an I-924A, as a ways of providing their annual reporting and statistics and job count and, you know, everything that has been spent on EB-5 funds versus non-EB-5 funds, basically.
Well, for years, I would say, though, the 924 was a routine and predictable event. It was just, when it began, it was like, okay, we have to fill this out, and what is USCIS even doing with the data? I don't think that's the case anymore.
Oh, no. You know, regional centers were just giving random numbers, but not this time. I mean, we stood there and calculated. I mean, we had to go through every project a regional center was designated on under. We had to go through each NCE. We had to go through each JCE. So they were very specific in asking all these questions related to each and individual entity that was under the RC.
Right. And this year we have seen that these NOITs are arriving so quickly, almost as soon as they've checked off whether or not they've even filed a 924, I think.
Yeah. And so what USCIS is doing as part of their integrity measures, they're now publishing EB-5 regional center termination notices on the website. So each notice will contain reasons for the termination and, of course, the procedures of how to appeal the termination, which we can go into further about what issues we'll see coming into terminating a regional center.
Yeah, I think what the important thing is to point out with these notices although it's not written anywhere, there's, of course, this is just policy. But the IPO's policy is to give a regional center about 3 years to sponsor projects and to get the EB-5 applications in. And bear in mind, Mark, that people have spent 100,000 plus on putting up regional centers. It's not a cheap thing. And that's why I say there was a cottage industry which had grown out of this.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's not cheap to put up a regional center. But I feel that those who are, you know, owners of these regional centers didn't take... weren't serious enough to know that, look, we have to do all this compliance. You know, you just don't earn a regional center, get, you know, support some projects and make money off of it.
Right. It's a serious business.
Right. It's not just compliance. I don't think a lot of people even understood how to go out and market. They thought they would go to China and the money would just fall in. Just the minute they had a regional center, it would just come to them. And it doesn't work that way. Marketing is heavy duty business, as we've discussed many times on this podcast series. Marketing in different countries involves dedication and money and time, which many people didn't realize when they were putting up a regional center.
Yeah, you need to know the market. And in addition to that, you need to know the flow of funds. You can't just accept the funds. And then after that, you don't know where it's going, what it's being used towards. It's very important to keep track of all of that.
Right. Well, just very, very briefly, Rebecca, I don't want to bore our audience, but how does one respond to a NOIT?
Okay, so as we were discussing earlier, there are several issues that could come up in a NOIT. Some of those, you know, as we discussed, is a lack of EB-5 capital investment or job creation for the last several fiscal years. Maybe you failed to respond that how many I-526 or I-829 petitions were filed under the regional center itself, or just the inability to file the I-924A and show that it's conducted any economic activity, basically. But there's several arguments that can be made to address those issues. For example, we've seen regional centers that have been out there and have made significant efforts in putting up a project, providing investment opportunities to EB-5 investors, maybe having a full set of project documents ready, and even going out there and marketing. However, you know, it's a business. Things can happen. You know, what if the project can no longer move forward? There's different issues. Maybe the market conditions are there.
Or a major lawsuit, perhaps.
Yeah, major lawsuit, conventional financing fell through.
Unfortunately, we're going to be seeing some of that coming forward.
Oh, yeah, that we can see. You know, maybe a lack of permits and licenses. I mean, there's so many issues that could come involved. And what USCIS needs to do is take into and recognize is that this is a business. There are unforeseeable circumstances that happen all the time. And so if you remember, you're reporting in one fiscal year, and what USCIS needs to take into consideration is that if you're doing this throughout several years, maybe you've had I-526 files in the past, maybe you had I-29s going to be filed in the next couple months. So you need to take an overall picture of the regional center and indicate to USCIS that, yes, maybe we didn't have much activity going on this year, but in the last few years or in the coming years, we will have significant activity.
Right. So what are the practical implications of a termination? That could be bifurcated in two ways. Take a regional center which hasn't done anything. What's the practical implication of a termination, Rebecca?
So if you have not done anything and you've been terminated, it's obvious that you cannot solicit, you cannot generate or promote investors or investments for any EB-5 related project, or basically no participation in the EB-5 program.
Okay. That actually sounds simple, but you'd be surprised how many people with terminated regional centers still feel that they're able to go out and do EB-5 with their regional centers. But anyway, what happens, though, if you have someone or you have investors actually in the regional center?
Yeah, so that's the scary part about it. As we've seen in the past, that regional centers that were terminated, USCIS was going to also forego all the investors in the regional center.
They can change now under the new regs.
Yes.
The new regs have allowed an investor to jump to a different regional center.
Yes, but you know, you have to be very careful in the timing of that, because it depends on if the application is still pending or if they have a conditional green card. You know, maybe their I-526 was approved. So it seems that...
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Yes.
And what about a project which would have investors at all different stages?
Yeah, so that's the scary part. But hopefully that we'll see that with the litigation and all of that going on, that you're able to go ahead and either maintain the regional center until all the I-526 has been approved and then maybe move it to another regional center or continue the activity until all I-29s have been approved.
So in a circumstance where you lose at a litigation, for example, and they say, no, we are going to terminate this regional center, what happens to the investors?
Unfortunately, they lose the EB-5. But like you mentioned, with the new regulation, then they could go ahead and file a new I-526 petition, but maintain their priority date.
So beware if you're renting and you don't know what you're renting.
Well, not only renting regional center, but just be careful of, as a regional center yourself, who you're bringing into the regional center. Because remember, it's the NCE that has to report a lot of this information. So you, as a regional center operative, are also relying on other project developers to provide you the information to file and to comply with all of USCIS's regulations.
Right. And if they're not complying, that's an issue in itself. So my issue really is that, yes, we need the RC compliance police to do their job. But there is a fine line between a regional center that should be closed and really when a termination is justified and when it could be considered arbitrary and capricious. One termination that was litigated, and it wasn't very long ago, December of 2019, is the matter of SDRC. And this is one of the first cases against USCIS. Here it was the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington, which found that USCIS's termination of a regional center was considered what they would say arbitrary and capricious, which is a term that you use if they basically want to say that they didn't have the right or they overstepped their mark. And they actually ordered USCIS to reopen and re-adjudicate the 526 petitions associated with that particular regional center. So we actually like to refer to that case often and look at what's called the positive and negative indicators test.
So I'm going to read from the court's decision, word for word. The court ruled, just because a regional center failed to promote economic growth for a short period of while management changed hands does not mean that the regional center has not continued to promote economic growth after that point when in fact provided jobs on a successful construction project.
The case shows also how in certain circumstances, criminal actions of a third party shouldn't really dictate the outcome of the investors. Because in this matter, in this case, we were shown to the court that the bad actors had been removed. There had been a receiver, I believe, appointed. And basically, they had done their best to restart everything. And USCIS were kind of, no, we don't care. And the court basically said, well, you should care because these people's lives are at stake and their investment and they have created jobs. So therefore, they should receive the green card. But while it's easy to blame USCIS for its sweeping, unapologetic termination, if you want to say, of regional centers over the past few years, I believe that a lot of criticism also should be placed upon regional centers themselves. There was a time, a long, long time ago, that, and for a very short period of time, we did actually think that regional centers were fine. Sorry, a developer was fine being his own regional center. Our experience has shown us the opposite.
Yeah, and that's where we've seen third-party oversight became prominent in that time. Because if you have a developer who's the regional center, also the project developer is also, doing X, Y, and Z, where is the oversight really?
That's the oversight on the money. But at the same time, for some of the criticism that USCIS had about bringing in investors, we did see that developers who were their own regional centers just didn't give any kind of emphasis or any kind of participation on not just admin oversight, but on either capital committed to the regional center or an oversight onto the investors themselves. They also often had in-house attorneys who really did not take into the investors' best interests into account. And they would put people in EB-5 petitions who should never have been doing EB-5 in the first place.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And like we said, we've seen that in RFVs ourselves. So it's very important to, even though you state in your regional center documents, USCIS will pull that up and state that, you know, how is it and how are you capable of funding the regional center, and how are you promoting, what are you using for your marketing activities? And also at the same time, what are you using for the compliance? How are you conducting compliance for these regional centers? So we've seen USCIS come back. It's no longer your typical boilerplate language, you know, RC filings that you're seeing anymore. You have to be very specific in how you personally, as a regional center operative, are going to run this regional center.
Right. Actually, there's a very nice quote from some, I can't recall quite now, but a person who wrote an article about regional center terminations, where it was quoted that the opportunity to operate a regional center is a privilege. I agree with that. I think it is a privilege, and I think that people who do not, unfortunately, follow the rules, it's quite intolerable, because what happens if a regional center neglects their responsibilities, it not only puts its own existence into jeopardy, but the investors with the unadjudicated 526 petitions and the possibility of their return of capital. And what is so unfair is that a project and the regional center themselves have benefited from maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars in investment capital.
Oh, yeah. And then we'll see that they'll continue to benefit, especially with the backlogs right now. So not only are they going to be able to use the $500,000 in a project that they've solicited EB-5 investors for, but thereafter, they'll be able to also redeploy the funds. So they will hang on to the capital for as long as, you know, until the EB-5 investor has their I-829 filed.
Right.
It'll be years.
And unfortunately, going back to what you said at the beginning on the difficulties that we're having with some of the operatives, even complying with the 924 is intolerable. Mm-hmm. We should not be seeing that at all. You know, if you have a project, if you have taken investment from investors, you have undertaken the burden of providing at least the minimum of compliance. And these might include the filings to USCIS, your SEC filings, oversight, and you should not shirk these responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. And that's where finding EB-5 attorneys, or, you know, those who are in this field, it's important to find the right ones, because you are a developer. You don't know anything, you know, of how to run an EB-5 regional center. So it's important to have that oversight, or at least be guided by attorneys who know what USCIS will be looking for on a compliance.
And anyone, I think, going forward, thinking they want to be a regional center, should also be aware that it's coming. I do believe it's coming this year, that we are going to receive some guidance from USCIS, which is going to put a lot more burden on regional centers. And they will not have the ability, if they rent, to basically say, well, we didn't know. I think there's going to be a much more there's going to be a much more burden of oversight, even when you are renting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No.
And we covered more about renting regional centers way back in episode 30 with Clem Turner. It was about a little over 3 years ago.
Gosh, well, I think we need to revisit that topic.
I think we do.
There's just so much more to discuss, you know. I mean, we're just hitting just, you know, the basics of what USCIS would require. But God, we could go on and on of what to really do for compliance and making sure regional centers are not going through termination.
And as well as what we have been seeing over the years with developers. It's interesting because some people are really eager. They want to do the right thing. And we have seen that. And it's heartwarming, quite frankly, because they've made every effort, not only to repay capital, but to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. While at the same time, there's a lethargy for regional centers where perhaps their market has now shrunk. Maybe regional centers who dealt more with the Chinese market, for example. And that's really where we really have a problem right now.
So what we're going to see moving forward is because of the increase of the investment amount. You know, regional centers at $500,000 were able to go ahead and get multiple investors for projects. But at the $900,000 level, or even at the $1.8 million level, you're not going to see as many investors as we've seen in the past. So, you know, the USCIS needs to also kind of look into that and see that you're not going to see the economic growth that we've seen in the past.
Well, Rebecca, you're right. You would hope that USCIS would look at the increased investment amount of EB-5 and understand the economics of it. And it's getting harder for developers as well as investors. And Mona, as you said earlier, regional centers and the developers, they just want to do the right thing. So I want to thank both of you for explaining the various compliance issues that may come up and how to avoid these notice of intent to terminate letters that are coming from USCIS. So thanks again, and let's talk next week.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.